This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barrys from Guardian Australia.
And welcome to Nikki Saba, award-winning journalist, commentator and author of many books, including the new one, Earthquake, The Election That Shook Australia. And that's the book that everybody should be reading over the Christmas break if they haven't already. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great to have you, Nikki, because we do plan to look back over the political year and discuss what lessons should be learned as they prepare for a new year. But before we do that, we'll take a look at two issues that I think dominated the week. The family reunion entitlements for federal MPs, of course, and Barnaby Joyce's defection to One Nation. I'll open up with one observation about the entitlement scheme in general. Like most of them, it's too generous, it's too open-ended, it's too easy to abuse. And every time the focus comes on any of these entitlements, the public goes nuts, partly because they don't get any perks. I think, though, we have to understand with this particular scheme that it, and if we can just put our prejudices aside for a second and appreciate that federal politicians, not uniquely, but it's rare, that they do spend 4 or 5 months a year outside of the home. So I think assistance, occasionally, to bringing their kids and partners to Canberra is not unreasonable. But Canberra, and Canberra only, not elsewhere, fly economy, and only occasionally. And the one point I want to make is that when the Prime Minister said, I don't make the rules, I don't think that cuts it. I think you either, as a leader, you go flat out defending the extravagance that is there in this now, the extravagance, or you rein it in. You do one or the other, saying, I don't make the rules, not for me. Tony?
Yeah, look, I feel that you trust cabinet ministers in particular to get the judgment right on this, and I think most of them do. But obviously Annika Wells didn't. The original sin was $100,000 for three of them to fly over to New York when she had a very small minor role as MC. And that was the sort of then causes, you know, the media to sort of investigate other examples where she was perhaps extravagant. But the most of them, I think, are pretty judicious in it. I don't think as judicious. I mean, I think back at one of Nikki's former bosses in politics who was notorious for being incredibly scrupulous with these things. But I think most of them get it right.
Nikki?
I agree with most of what you both have said. Look, if voters had their way, politicians would get nothing, would be paid nothing, and in fact would be expected to contribute to the public purse. So, you know, we have to be careful. If we want good people to run for parliament, we have to be prepared to meet the expenses. Where it's all gone haywire is that a few of the politicians think that means every expense that confronts them and their families, and that's just not right. And they have to exercise some judgment and common sense about the way taxpayers' money is being used. I don't think that's happened. I agree with Barry. The Prime Minister should have come out days ago and said, look, yes, okay, these expenses might be within the guidelines, but we need to look at the guidelines. And if they fall outside community expectations, then we should change them. The only other observation I will make here is that while Annika has a bit of explaining to do, she was by no means top of the list of the big spenders. And in fact, she was, you know, down around the bottom somewheres.
Number 28 on the list in terms of the biggest users.
Number 28. I'm just curious as to why the opposition landed on Annika just as the social media ban was coming in. I mean, anyone would think that the opposition didn't want the ban to succeed.
Yeah, that's part of it. But I think, Tony, and I heard you on radio on this, you said it's because of her original sin.
Yeah.
And you've already talked about the $100,000 FS for three of them, for her and two staffers. But I don't think you can be as dismissive of her contribution to the UN by saying she was MC for 6.5 minutes. That's a massive opportunity to take a very worthwhile scheme to the world. And that's what she did.
Yeah, but think this is where, you know, your senior advisors in your office look at it and just go, yep, we've had this Optus crisis emergency develop. We can't get anything approaching reasonable airfares. And by the way, they don't book on the Qantas website like we all do. It's through a travel agency and they get massive discounts. So how it ended up is $34,000.
Because it was last minute. That's why.
That is still an extraordinary fee.
Sure is.
But I think that is the sort of issue that really resonates. And the danger for Albanese is, I mean, you know, he said on radio this week, well, I don't hold a hose, you know. And I think the Sydney Morning Herald had a great headline on Friday saying, you know, I don't make the rules, ... says the ruler. And so that was a rare misstep from Albanese in 2025. The danger is, I think it just resets the political conversation. It was all about the coalition, net zero, some of its structural vote problems. And they still exist, those structural vote problems. But it allowed voters to sort of refocus back onto the government. And next year is going to be a very challenging year for the government in terms of the economy.
Yeah. One final observation on this. When the full list was published, it came out that two ministers claimed nothing. Imagine the situation, this scene, right? When the minister comes home and the partner's sitting there saying, I've just been reading the newspapers and I noticed that a backbencher from Queensland, legitimately apparently, spent $123,000 to have family time in Canberra during the year and you claimed zero. Yeah. I think this is something we should be talking about. Yeah. Just at the other end of the spectrum, I can't understand how anybody would claim zero
That was a member for Dawson, which is based in Mackay, my hometown.
No, that's the 123,000. Yeah,
yeah. And yeah. I can tell you, Qantas regional flights are extortionate. Yeah, I can fly to Brisbane for like a third of the cost to go from Brisbane to regional Queensland.
Yeah, but it's still an enormous amount of money for a backbencher to be spending.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that has really damaged Anika is the Comcar, keeping the Comcar waiting. Look, yeah, the airfares to New York were exorbitant, but people know what airlines are like. But keeping the Comcar waiting is one of the things that's really hurt her and hasn't properly been explained, I think.
And just one note on the member for Dawson. At least if member for Dawson headed south to Canberra, whereas the previous one constantly headed north to Manila.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, Barnaby Joyce and One Nation. We talked about this last week, Tony, so we'll give Nikki first crack at this. But do you think, Nikki, that he can boost support for Pauline Hanson and One Nation?
Well, anything is possible in politics. So, yeah, he probably could. But, you know, I've just got this thing about rats, you know, once a rat, always a rat. And I've never known stories about rats to have a happy ending. It never seems to work out that way. And I was just watching the two of them the other day when they made the announcement, and I'm thinking, I wonder how long this lovey-dovey relationship is going to last. The first time that Pauline tries to tell Barnaby what to do and how he should do it, maybe wear a burqa in the house or something, I don't know, I cannot see that they will get along. They're just so, in many ways, very similar characters, right? They're used to having their own way and doing their own thing. And I don't think either of them will take any counsel from the other. So I don't know how long it's going to last. But let's say they do, you know, work it all out between them. And he makes a big run for the Senate. Is he guaranteed of winning a seat in New South Wales? What if there's some brilliant independent that the Teals swing out against him? That's going to make life a bit interesting too.
Yeah, I think they'll do all right in the Senate. Anthony Green put up an interesting proposition during the week. He said that if they go to 14 senators, and, you know, that's probably imminent, the population changes demand this after a time, then the next half-Senate election, they'd be electing 8 senators from each state. That would be a quota of 11.5%. That's not difficult to achieve if you've got Barnaby Joyce's profile.
I've been a sceptic about the expanded parliament. I absolutely accept the reasons for it, and they're valid, but I also appreciate the politics of it and the media's views on these things. I think the last week's events, Albanese will run a million miles. Now, let's face it, he's not a courageous fellow. He could have got the superannuation policy through. I thought it was a flawed policy. I thought the principles underpinning it were fair, but, you know, the unrealised gains and those sort of other aspects. Mate, if he couldn't get that policy through and pull the pin on it, I can't see him expanding Parliament, and Don Farrell's going to have to argue the case as to all these entitlements. Bearing in mind, Don Farrell was one of the worst offenders on the list of family reunion flights.
He was, I think, top three, very high on the list anyway. Just on the One Nation, though, on the House of Representatives. Now, I've read some speculation they could win 12 or 15 seats in the House. I just don't accept that. Look, if you've got a 15% primary, even if that held up, and I think the protest votes are high in opinion polls, not so high in real elections. So I don't think the 15% will hold up for a start. But then they have to get the 80% or more of coalition preferences, and the coalition primary vote is down at historically low levels. So I just don't see how the numbers add up so that they can pick up any more than, say, a handful of seats, you know, two, three or four in key areas for them.
Yeah, at the moment there's nothing there to suggest that'll happen. And you're right, often people will park their votes as a protest and then come back home. Now, I'm not sure. It's a very volatile electoral cycle coming up, and we've discussed a lot of these undercurrents, but it's still hard to see picking up anything more than one or two seats, and most likely none, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, the year in politics now, and look, we'll go to the government first, and you talked about Albanese had a lack of courage on the superannuation thing, but the criticism that comes in, they're too slow in terms of, you know, on the pace of reform. They, though, in their defence, say that it's incremental, they're cautious, but they have spent, 7 months since the election on delivering on what they promised. That's the first thing they want to do, which then raises expectations that they're going to be more daring through next year. It's not an election year. It's a lot of political stability, political dominance on the part of the government. So, Nikki, do you think this was the year of delivery and then next year will be the year of reform?
It better be. I think people are hanging out for it, and I think Albanese should be smart enough to embrace it. I mean, I don't think it'll be good enough or acceptable for the government to simply mark time again for a whole year. They have delivered on what they said they would, but their mandate is not just to deliver on what they promised at the election. Their mandate is to ensure that Australia is in a good place to handle whatever might come next. And that means there has to be reform to the tax system, there has to be reform to regulation, there have to be reforms across the board. We've seen in the past when Albanese, and Tony talked about this before on the superannuation, whenever things start to get a bit tricky, he backs off. Well, he can't afford to back off this time around, I don't think.
He's now won two elections, 2 years out on the next one, but he'll be the leader, no doubt, going into the next one. And given that they would need to lose 18 seats just to lose majority government, you'd think he'd be Prime Minister again. What do you think his attitude would then be? Bob Hawke set the Labor record at 4. Will he bat on to try and reach the sort of political equivalent of a cricket century? or do you think he would say, well, that's a fair achievement and now the party needs freshening up?
Well, we've seen it all before, haven't we? I mean, Bob Hawke had an agreement with Paul Keating that he would step aside. They each had a witness to that agreement. Hawke had Peter Abels and Keating had Bill Keelty, and then Hawke reneged on it. And John Howard said, you know, he'd look at things when he was 64, he'd probably be ready to give it away. And then they talked themselves into believing that no one else can do the job as good as they can.
Yep.
So they decide to hang around well past the time when they should go. I did write about this in the book, and in my view, if he wants Labor to be the party of natural government, he should go sooner rather than later to allow the party to regenerate and to avoid a bloodbath, because it always ends in a bloodbath for the leader, or the leader gets defeated and loses his own seat at the election. We've seen that time and time, but they get into this mindset, right? I mean, Gerry Hand said to me, they all go mad, which they do. They lose perspective completely. They think they're superhuman and the party can't get along without them. And they think, you know, it's best for everyone that they stay, when in fact it's best for everyone if they go.
Yeah, and you're right about Hawke didn't accept that three was enough. He won a fourth election and then still didn't accept that that was enough. And I think in the end it became more about, you know, not wanting Keating to carry on with the legacy.
Yeah. Let's put it to one side, the dysfunction of the coalition and opposition, for one moment. I know it's hard to ignore, but let's just put it to one side. There are a lot of challenges for this government next year. The RBA already talking about interest rate rises. That's going to be very hard for the government to slip that punch. The cash register never lies. You know, and on things like energy prices, people will go, you know, their bills are still going up. They're projected to continue rising. There are a lot of significant challenges for this government to navigate. And I come back to Keating, who was famous for saying, use it or lose it when it comes to power, which goes to Nikki's point. Reform, something bold, something that gives voters a reason, a next term agenda to vote for.
Okay, well, let's now go to the coalition, and looking back on the year, the election was obviously the standout. It was the earthquake that the election that shook Australia, and the title of Nikki's book. The scale of that, Nikki, it was the scale of it that took a lot of people a considerable amount of time to really get their head around.
And coming on top of 2022, which was also an extraordinary election, whereby the Liberal Party lost its small L Liberal heartland. That result was huge, I thought, and the Liberal Party decided to carry on as if nothing unusual had happened. And some people are making the same mistake this time. Oh, yes, it was a bad result, but look, we've come back from, you know, really difficult times before. And that's true, but this is very different. They've lost their Liberal heartland. They're losing their Conservative heartland. I mean, the One Nation vote is not coming from nowhere. It's coming from either the National Party or the Liberal Party, to a much lesser extent, the Labor Party. Now, what is that telling you? It's telling you that the Liberal Party base is disintegrating. And yes, they've had a couple of good weeks on the entitlements. They've managed to run that issue very well, but that doesn't go anywhere near solving any of their core structural problems, like, what do they stand for? What do they believe? Who are they speaking to? Do they know how to speak to modern Australia today? I don't think they do, and they haven't been doing that for a long time. Do they even like what modern Australia has become? I don't see any evidence in large sections of the Liberal Party that they either like or understand what Australia has become. And I think they've got to sort all that out. I don't see really much effort being put into it to fix it. And they certainly aren't fixing their physical infrastructure problems when it comes to party organisations. And here I'll just quickly throw in Jess Wilson in Victoria, who could be the best Liberal leader that they've had in a very long time. But if they don't know how to run a really good campaign in Victoria, she's not going to be Premier in November.
Yeah. We will talk about that a little later on. But, Tony, where's the evidence that they understand what went wrong and how to right it? I remember that Robert Kennedy quote of Jack Kennedy, that he knew wrong and how to right it. I wonder with the Liberal Party these days, whether they understand what went wrong. They certainly don't yet give any evidence they know how to right it.
Yeah. I feel that there is a misunderstanding of what happened, not just last time, but 2022. There's always a tendency in the party to have a messiah complex, but also find a scapegoat. It's too much to lay the blame at the feet of ScoMo and Peter Dutton, because we've seen at state level catastrophic results. South Australia, there was a poll published on the weekend that showed a 61% 2PP for Labor. The Liberal Party could be reduced just to rural seats in South Australia.
Yeah, I want to talk about those state elections just a little later, but will there be a point in the next 2 years where the penny seems to drop and they start doing positive things that gives them a bit of a boost in the polls?
So, I mean, if you could fix one problem, and there's many, it'd be being competitive in urban seats again, which are diverse, they're usually younger, a lot of people from the country migrate to the cities. You and I are two examples, Barry. If you can fix the urban seat problem, they're numerically competitive again. But, of course, what we're seeing at not just at a federal level, but at state levels, they're just not competitive. I mean, even in Queensland, where Chris Foley won, and he's a very good product, political product, but he won regional seats. Queensland is the outlier in Australia because 48% of the population is regional. In Victoria, for example, 85% is in Melbourne. So they overperformed in the country. They only won three seats in metropolitan Brisbane. It was a bit of a canary in the coal mine in hindsight, but the seat of Pine Rivers was the most marginal in Brisbane. Now, that is in the population centre of Dixon, Peter Dutton's seat. Mm. That was expected to fall by about 7:15. But the Labor Party held on to it. Now, in hindsight, we can look back and say, well, actually, that was the first indicator that Dutton was in trouble because, you know, that seat did not fall. Why did it not fall? But it goes to this recurring theme of we're not competitive at an urban level. But I'd like to ask Nikki and then you, Barry, because you've had front seats, say, the Liberal Party in 2005 compared to the Liberal Party 2025. What has changed?
Well, firstly, in my view, they were, as John Howard used to call it, a broad church. It was a broader church than it is now. 2005, there was a moderate wing of the Liberal Party, and there were some very good and effective people operating within that wing. When they started to lose them and the Teals emerged, it was good riddance. That was the attitude, good riddance. Well, then they became a right-wing party and lost support. Nikki?
Well, I agree with that. They had a very strong, moderate wing. And they used their power and their influence to keep the party centred. And once they lost those people, the moderates were not only depleted in numbers, but also in strength and power and influence. And I keep saying about the right will never stop until they get what they want. What was left of the moderate wing of the Liberal Party literally just went to water. They would put up a token kind of resistance inside the party and then they would give up. They would raise the white flag. And that is happening again now. The right is winning every argument. Back in 2005, the moderates would actually win a few arguments as well. They were very powerful and they were articulate and they were not afraid to go out there and fight for what they believed in. I think all that has disappeared and the right is now very firmly in control, both inside Parliament and outside Parliament.
And Tony, you were in the thick of it back in 2005. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think also they've abandoned the economy. They've given that away to Labor for free. And Nikki's book, I thought the most interesting part of Nikki's book, and I don't want to be a spoiler alert here for the people who haven't read it yet and how it ends, but it's not a happy ending for the Liberal Party, but I won't say anything more. But, you know, I thought the most interesting storyline in that book was about Jim Chalmers with the budget, throwing out the tax cut. It was a very modest tax cut, and the coalition not following. And so, therefore, they gave the economic debate to Labor for free. Chalmers became the lower taxing, smaller deficit treasurer, which is incredible to me.
All right, we're going to take a break now and then look at the two state elections due next year.